Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The buffalo is an old, old breed. You know, it's been a friend of man in a lot of poor places around the globe. They've been considered the friend of the peasant.
That's local entrepreneur Jeff Meese, the manager of one of the few water buffalo herds in the U.S. We visit his farm to meet these majestic animals. Then, two gardeners talk about how they successfully grow food even when there's snow on the ground. And we'll go into the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr to make a dish using potatoes and rutabagas and two hearty stews with bison meat. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. But first, Earth Eats news blogger Liz Leslie is here with a look at the food stories that made headlines this week. Hey there, Liz.
Hey, Annie. Good to be here. Organic milk is in greater demand, but shorter supply. Farmers have had to curtail production of organic milk due to higher prices of organic feed coupled with stagnant prices on milk. If you're one of those lucky enough to get your hands on a carton of organic milk, expect to start paying more soon. A South Dakota company discovered 8 years ago that if parts of beef that were formerly considered waste or low grade were injected with ammonia, the meat would be safe from E. coli and salmonella. Beef Products, Inc. marketed the cheap option, and it was picked up by fast food restaurants and school lunch programs until it was discovered that the ammonia wasn't killing all the bacteria. Beef Products, however, stands by their meat. They point out no illnesses have ever been traced to them. And, speaking of bacteria, the Food and Safety Inspection Services sent a notice to manufacturers of listeria-prone foods to be consistent in their sanitation. Makers of foods like cold cuts and hot dogs that are tested for listeria every 4 years. Knowing this, some manufacturers change their habits ahead of inspection, like cutting production, cleaning more, or removing machines that have had listeria outbreaks associated with them in the past. The FSIS warned that by doing so, the manufacturers are putting consumers at risk by skewing listeria detection. You can read more about these stories and many more on our website, eartheats.org.
And follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats. Liz Leslie is a news blogger for Earth Eats. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Industrial agriculture has become one of the most popular ways to farm today, even when done on a family scale. High stocking density, economies of scale, and modern machinery are just some of the current components that many farmers consider vital to their agricultural achievement. But one Morgan County family is challenging these modern views by not using heavy machinery and feeding their animals organically raised grain. From the WFIU newsroom, Alexis O'Brien reports on how the Simpson family has found success the natural way.
Living in a 19th century home near Martinsville, the Simpsons are the sixth generation in their family to live on and farm the 300 acres originally obtained in 1828. Though the husband and wife team behind the Simpson operation never planned to farm, Darby and Brandy found that livestock was easy to sell, so they took advantage of the opportunity.
Actually, my first love is gardening. So the first year in 2007, we did some vegetables, but we also decided to raise some chickens. We just found the livestock to be a lot easier to sell because there was really not a whole lot of access for that kind of product.
The Simpsons focus on chickens, pigs, cattle, laying hens, turkey, and sheep they naturally raise. Holding a very holistic view, this family believes what distinguishes them from other organic farms is their practice of feeding only organically raised grain to their animals. Because it's free of chemicals, pesticides, and insecticides, it is not genetically modified. Darby says naturally raised meat has many benefits.
People really start to enjoy food again. They enjoy cooking. It actually has flavor. It doesn't make you sick. It heals your body.
With the production of such wholesome products also comes techniques that aren't usually used by farmers. Because the Simpsons don't use any type of machinery, they use their animals, particularly beef-feed cattle, as lawnmowers. Darby says rotating livestock through the pastures allows for better soil and increased grass growth.
We're building soil, trying to get that micro-life just teeming in the soil so that we're getting good organic matter so we can grow more grass, basically. So yeah, it's this pasture's been used four or five different times between April and October.
The Simpsons are happy with what their farm has become and admit they've had to learn a lot along the way. Brandy says the greatest challenge is preparing yourself to be ready for anything.
And you always have to expect the unexpected. You can have a set to-do list for your day, but you can always plan on something going wrong.
Yeah.
Fence being down or, you know, pigs trying to get out of their fence. Something always goes on.
For this family, with each challenge comes a new learning opportunity. In addition to running their organic farm, Darby and Brandy are raising two young boys who may be led to work on the farm someday as well. They all take pride in their natural approach, saying they work daily to nourish the mind, soul, and body on Simpson Farms. Alexis O'Brien, WFIU News.
You can read more about natural farming methods on our website, eartheats.org. Just because winter weather has taken hold of the Midwest doesn't mean that area gardeners are taking a break. It takes quite a bit of planning in the fall and perhaps even more attention and care than gardening in the spring and summer, but it is possible to harvest fresh food when there's snow on the ground.
Oh my goodness, the title. I'm still working on that one. But my name is Jamie Scholl.
She's the president of My Edible Eden, through which she offers gardening and permaculture advice and also sells a series of planting calendars for the various climate zones.
I'm one of these strange people. It's like when someone asks me, can you teach the putting the garden to bed class? I'm like, well, because I usually don't typically put my garden to bed. I utilize it all the time.
So like right now in her garden, she's planted bok choy, Jerusalem artichokes, sweet peas, kale, cabbages, and believe it or not, her tomatoes are still producing. She planted all these cold weather crops in August and September, and she hopes to be harvesting off them for the next few months. She scoffs at the notion that folks in the Midwest can't eat locally year-round.
Now, you won't be able to eat all of your food possibly as fresh, but it is possible, especially if you're going to preserve the harvest, whether it's drying, smoking, canning. There's a lot of different options. Freezing, it depends on how energy intensive you want to be.
Eating preserved foods is one thing, but is she really picking fresh food from her garden when there's snow on the ground?
You can. I have. I've harvested carrots before, the covering of straw. The straw will insulate. So a straw is hollow in the center, and that is like insulation. It provides a lot of, think of a straw bale house. That's an amazing amount of insulation there, more than a typical house. So if you cover your root veggies with this, you'll easily keep the ground from freezing and then be able to harvest. They'll actually be very sweet and much more tasty.
So here we are out in the garden, and I've got my cold frames right there. I've got two cold frames.
Novice gardener Lee Bush is attempting to grow food in the winter for the first time. She's a grad student in the food studies program at Indiana University in Bloomington.
So what I'm going to do is try and spread straw all over the places that will be exposed to the winter air. And then I can show you what's going on inside my cold frames if you like.
Yes, please.
Okay.
The cold frames are basically garden beds enclosed on all four sides by 2x4s and then covered with a clear lid to enhance the light and energy coming from the sun. She had help building the first cold frame, but made the second one all on her own, and she refers to that as her first success in the garden.
This frame was built from leftover wood in our house, and the shower curtain was from a friend who was going to take it to Goodwill, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, I bet I could staple that to the frame and put it on top, and it'll function like a greenhouse. So we're going to see how it works. I've got some pretty sturdy vegetables in here, and I actually have a whole row of sprouts of seeds I planted that I don't know what they are. And I'm like, oh, you can make it. You can make it. Just, I wish I knew what you were.
In addition to the mystery seeds, she has kale and turnips and spinach in the beds. The turnips and spinach especially are going nuts, but she's worried that they're starting to crowd each other.
Because I broadcasted those seeds and they're doing so well, I don't know how much I'm willing to thin them because they look so delicious, but I don't want to stunt their growth. So as a novice gardener, it's the one thing that I'm really curious about is when to thin and when to let them go on their own.
They may end up growing together, you know, fine. Some of them may die, or they just grow closely. Or you could just harvest them now and have a baby spinach salad.
Bush also wanted to know about laying down straw in her cold frame. Will this help the plant survive better, or will it actually make them too warm?
Now, snow insulates, so you're going to have it around 32 degrees, and it depends upon how frequently you want to eat from it. So what you're growing now, or had been since August, is what's going to be eaten on. Now, the plant will not die. It will slow its growth, so you want to keep the plant alive and eat what is there. But it'll be okay. Just make sure it's covered. Otherwise, put the straw on.
And the other question is that I planted a bunch of garlic, and I planted a bunch of garlic maybe a month ago, and it seems to be doing really well, and I see all the green shoots. But all the other garlic that I planted maybe a week or two ago, I'm not seeing anything from it, and I'm wondering, I'm not sure if I waited too long or if it's just real slow because it did get colder over those last 2 weeks, and it's just going to be sort of dormant throughout the winter.
You can plant garlic a lot of different times of the year. I mean, I know some farmers nearby who will plant it all the way up into December. Your harvest time will be different. The size of the bulbs may be different depending upon when you harvest them. So it's about a 10-month cycle for garlic. So I wouldn't worry. It'll be fine.
Jamie Scholl's website is myedibleeden.com. And you can see photos of Lee Bush's cold frames on our website, eartheats.org. To the kitchen now. Chef Daniel Orr picked up some root vegetables to use in this recipe, which he borrowed from his grandmother, a Polish rutabaga mash.
So these are the rutabagas, and again, this is one of those very intimidating vegetables. You go to the market and you don't know what the heck to do with it. You know, so a lot of people just walk right on by, like the old song goes. But they're very, very easy to use. In Scotland, they call them nips, a classic Burns dinner. Is the haggis with nips and taties, which are mashed turnips, or rutabaga, and mashed potatoes. It's got a firmer flesh than a turnip. A turnip is more watery. This is a little more crunchy. I'll let you taste a little raw.
Oh, rutabaga.
Get that sweetness at the beginning, and then it gets a little more aggressive towards the end.
These are big suckers. They're waxy, too.
So with these, we're just going to cut them up into uniform pieces so they all cook the same. You're going to trim off the exterior, and the wax is there to keep them fresh. You know, there are a lot of vegetables that they treat and they wax that you really need to be careful with, like such as, you know, even lemons are often lightly waxed to seal in flavor. So that's, if you're going to use the zest of a lemon, it's always good to buy an organic, untreated lemon, but almost all rutabagas are waxed, and it's very evident that they are waxed. Okay, and then we'll just set these aside. And what I've done is I've already got some cooked. I cooked them about halfway in water and then drained them off and then added some chicken stock. And this is what my grandmother Orr used to do. And I'm just going to cook this down a little bit.
They look like little peaches. They have sort of a soft peach color now.
Yeah, as they cook, they turn a little bit darker. And then over here, I've got some potatoes that cook the same way. Okay, I'm going to add a pinch of sugar and a little bit of lemon zest. Okay, Grandma didn't put the lemon zest in.
This is your touch.
But that's my touch. Okay, I'm going to add these to the potatoes. We have about equal amount of potatoes and rutabagas. I'm going to add a little bit of butter, okay, and a little bit of heavy cream. Okay, I'm just going to take a whisk and kind of start mashing it up. And I'm not going to mash these up too much. I don't really want a puree. I want kind of a rustic mash.
There's nothing that warms my heart more than a big bowl of mashed things.
I'm
very excited about this.
Okay, and that is our mashed rutabaga. Grandma Orr's mashed rutabaga and potato side dish.
The tears and the sadness you gave me when you said goodbye.
Coming up, we visit entrepreneur Jeff Meese on his farm, where he introduces us to his herd of water buffaloes. Then it's back to the kitchen to prepare two hearty dishes using American buffalo meat, or bison. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods, with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood and on West 6th Street, two blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square, and online at goodsforcooks.com.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Jeff Meese is a restaurateur by trade, owning a number of pizza places in south central Indiana. But his true passion seems to be his 69-acre farm and his herd of water buffalo. Chef Daniel Orr and I stopped by his farm on a cold, snowy day back in 2009.
Well, you know, around the world, the buffalo is an old breed. You know, it's been a friend of man in a lot of poor places around the globe. They've been considered the friend of the peasant because they survive on such low grade feed. You know, where places where the people barely have enough to eat or don't have enough to eat. You know, what do you feed the animals? Like, I've been trying to make the buffalo down there a bed out of straw, but they keep eating it. They eat all the darn straw. So, and they seem to prefer the straw to the hay.
So do you want to, can we walk down?
We can. I'll give a couple cautions about them. They're funny with new people, which probably, I don't think they'll be aggressive with you, but they, you know, what the buffalo does when it's going to get aggressive is it puts its head down, like looks at the ground. So if that happens, best to just, you know, don't turn tail and run. Make yourself big and stomp, you know. Okay, so it's not that easy to do with a big, you know, 1,000-pound animal, I realize, but. And let me tell you a little bit about this herd. Myrtle and the big white one, and Myrtle's little orange daughter, Ginger. Come on, Myrtle, come on, let's get a bagel. Come on, girl. Myrtle, so they came from one herd, and they were quite tame, hand-fed, all that. The other ones were kind of range animals. One is just won't even come near me still. A couple of them sort of seem like they're ready to take me out, and the rest are in varying stages of that. Come on, sweetie, come on.
Now, with I always think of water buffalo coming from India and kind of warmer areas.
Yeah.
How do they do out here in the snow? We're standing out here in 15 inches of snow. How are they dealing with it, and do they enjoy the cold weather?
Well, they haven't been able to tell me how much they like it. There are several water buffalo farms in Canada now. The only two that exist in the U.S. is up in Vermont. So they seem to do fine. They're very adaptable. It's a very hardy animal. It's all right.
What makes the mozzarella from the water buffalo different from, you know, if they did the same process with goats or cows or sheep?
Okay. Well, you got to understand that I'm not a cheesemaker yet. but what I understand from asking that question to people is that, number one, water buffalo milk is much higher in butterfat. So you've got that heavy fat creaminess to it. I'm told that the fat globule is just, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't, even if you took butterfat out of cow's milk and added it back in, you couldn't make the same kind of thing. Also, water buffalo apparently process the beta carotene differently than cows, and so their milk is much whiter, and so mozzarella di bufala is a very, very white cheese.
When I was working and living in New York, we'd always go down to Little Italy, where they made the mozzarella with cow's milk.
Okay.
And what I found so interesting about it is that it's a very fresh product. It's not aged. They basically stretch these globules out, and it's ready to go right away, and it's kind of the fresher the mozzarella, the better.
Come on, sweetie. Come on.
Listen to the complete conversation with Jeff Meese and see photos of the water buffalo on our website, eartheats.org. Bison, also commonly called American buffaloes, are only distantly related to the buffaloes on Meese's farm. The meat is called America's original red meat because bison was the main protein source for Plains Indians until the animals were nearly hunted to extinction in the late 19th century. These days, in addition to wild bison herds in national parks and nature preserves, farms are keeping bison as livestock. According to the website eatbisonmeat.com, Indiana boasts 34 bison farms, including Buffalo Nickel Ranch in Monroe County. Chef Orr is using bison meat in this chili recipe. Here's his bison pumpkin and lentil chili.
Today we are going to do another wonderful winter dish. And this you can make ahead and eat for several days. You could make a sloppy joe with it for one meal. You could put it on top of a hot dog for another meal. Or you could just have a bowl of chili and serve it with one of my grandmother's biscuits, some sour cream, and some scallions. So you can make a big batch of this. It does freeze well, too. All right, so just a little bit of olive oil. You could use any type of fat that you like. We're going to add the bison. And you can see the bison's a real rich, dark, almost burgundy-looking meat. It's very, very lean. It's actually leaner than turkey. Just going to break that up. Okay, and we're going to just start adding the other ingredients. It's a really simple recipe. It's just about tossing all this stuff in. We're going to add our red and green peppers. We've got some diced carrots. Lots of onions. You can't have too many onions in a chili. A couple cups of fresh diced tomatoes. About 2 cups of canned tomatoes. We've got 1/4 cup of sorghum. Now, sorghum is a type of molasses that we use. It comes from a grain that's kind of close to a corn. It has a nice sweet flavor, kind of like molasses. Do you want to try it?
Let's give this a shot. Ooh, that's so rich.
I'm going to toss all this together.
I can smell the onions already.
And at Earth Eats, where there are onions, what usually follows?
Garlic, absolutely. Of course.
So we got our garlic. Got probably a couple tablespoons of garlic. Okay, and now we're going to add our seasonings. We've got my favorite sweet seasons, which is that kind of Chinese five-spice flavor. We've got some ground cumin, some cayenne pepper, which is going to give it a little bit of a bite, and a little bit of cinnamon. Okay, and we just got a couple more ingredients. This is where the Columbus Cowboy comes in. This is the some old coffee. So when you have leftover coffee, don't throw it away. What I like to do is to use it in chilies and stews. Red Eye gravy actually has coffee in it, so it's a nice gravy you can make out of coffee. The other thing you can do is you can pour it into an ice cube tray, and then if you like iced coffee, instead of putting regular ice in it, you can use frozen coffee ice cubes.
Oh, here comes the pumpkin.
Here comes the pumpkin. And what this is going to do is add a touch of sweetness as well as give it a nice, rich, creamy viscosity to the chili. And the last ingredient is the lentils. We're just going to top this off with enough water to moisten it all up. Again, we don't want to add too much and have to boil it down for a long time. The lentils are going to absorb some of the water. So we're going to let this come to a full boil, reduce the temperature to a simmer, and then let it simmer for about a half an hour or until it gets nice and thick and chili-like.
Bison is a good substitute for beef since it's lower in both fat and cholesterol. But for our final recipe today, we're going to use some beef brisket anyway. You do want to use one of the tougher cuts or varieties of meat because we're going to stew it for 2 to 3 hours.
So we've got these nice big hunks of meat. You want them about an inch and a half inch to an inch cubes. I'm going to season this. I've got some of my au poivre blend, which is a mixture of 5 peppercorns, fennel seeds, and coriander seeds. But you could use just cracked black pepper or spices that you like. I'm going to season this with a little bit of salt. Okay, and what that's going to do is it's going to start bringing the moisture to the surface of the meat. And then we're going to toss it in the flour. And this is going to enrobe the beef, and it's going to give it a really nice color when we sear it. Also, the flour, as it cooks, it's going to thicken the liquids that we add later, and that's what's going to give your stew that nice, rich viscosity. Okay, we have a little bit of oil. Okay, I'm just adding this. You can hear it sizzling. This would be almost like making a bœuf bourguignon, which is a classic French beef stew that Julia Child was very famous for. I think she had like a 4-page recipe for it.
That's right, that's right.
Just shake it around a little bit. We don't want anything to burn. We're also letting that flour cook, which you don't want to have a real kind of pasty tasting stew, which if you just threw some white flour in there, what we're doing is we're actually making a roux, and it's equal parts of flour and fat, usually butter. But we're making that just in the pan with this, using the meat fats, the olive oil that I put in there, and the flour that we rolled the meat in. You want to get that nice, what they call in French, a fond, and that's what the brown color is giving you. It's giving you that kind of rich, nutty, toasty flavor that you want. And give it the time. This is one of the most important parts of making a stew, is this browning and this caramelization. Okay, once we have the meat all nicely caramelized, we're going to add our nice big chunky onions.
And we got the carrots.
Okay, we've got some nice big chunky carrots. Again, rustic cut. And you can use whatever you have. You could use all different kinds of root vegetables, celery root, parsnip, turnips would be great in here. I'm going to put a couple orange peels in there. It's going to give it a kind of a unique flavor. And you do want to salt your stew at the beginning, because you want that salt to be absorbed into the meat. Okay, I'm going to throw in a couple bay leaves, and of course some whole cloves of garlic.
Your favorite.
Okay, now we're going to add some red wine. Okay, and we're going to cook this until the red wine evaporates, and then we're just going to top it with a little bit of water, just so everything kind of bobs in there like they're treading water. And then stew it until it's tender, about 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Through the magic of radio, we fast forward. It's got a nice thick consistency to it.
Nice, and you see the big chunks of beef in there, the potatoes, which we added in the last half an hour cooking, and the onions and everything. It's all kind of melted down to a nice sauce. All right, so we're going to take some buttered noodles, whatever you have. You could use spaghetti or egg noodles. Okay, we're going to dish out some of that nice chunky stew. Perfect thing for a cold, blustery winter afternoon.
This is a great recipe to make for a group of friends. It yields about 1.5 gallons of stew. Find all the recipes from today's episode on our website. Read interviews and news updates, and subscribe to our weekly podcast while you're there. It's all at eartheats.org. Special thanks to all the folks who helped make Earth Eats possible, including Lee Bush, Dan Goldblatt, Liz Leslie, Jeff Meese, Chef Daniel Orr, and Jamie Scholl.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods, with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood, and on West 6th Street, 2 blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square, and online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Join us next week as we cook with another root vegetable, the sunchoke. And we visit a hoop house in Bloomington to see how one organization is successfully growing kale, spinach, and all sorts of cold weather greens throughout the winter. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.